Well, firstly, I want to thank John for inviting me to do this show. It's really an honor, you know. And thanks for coming out on a beautiful Wednesday night. It's great to deliver something to, a mat. It's great. I'll try and speak loudly. There's a little bit of echo, but if I'm talking like this, what do you think? Can you hear me, Chuck? Okay. This will be about 25 minutes. Oh, and so what we'll do is, this is how this will work. So I speak, and then I'm done. So we won't do any questions. I like dialogue and stuff, but that's not really what this is about. So what we can do is, like, when I'm done, you clap or you don't clap, and then you see what I look like, and if you want to talk to me, you just talk. I don't mean the poo-poo question and answers. It's just not that kind of a thing. Okay. I originally meant to write something much different for this talk. This seems to be a theme for me in my work lately, intending one thing while stumbling into another that is more interesting, and therefore more pressing. I've learned to give myself to it, this new relationship to my practice. What has remained relatively constant is that whenever I finish a work, and I consider this room a work, whenever I finish a work, I try to build upon it with another. In this case, it's happening right now. This delivery, presently underway. It starts as a reflection, turns into notes scrawled on the backs of envelopes and scraps of old student papers, then gets organized into something that resembles a writing. It's always actually much too informal for a finished writing, so its first iteration, the one now unfolding, is intended for speech. It's meant to be spoken. Much later, I'll return to this and reshape it into something that works better in print. At any rate, I love and appreciate the invitation to make new work. And even though it's summer, and I'd be fine on my porch, looking at my flowers, touching them, wondering if they're placed properly, if their arrangement fits both my needs, which are largely visual, and their needs, largely material, the amount of sun each gets, wind, various sorts of shade and rainfall due to an overhanging apple tree and what I think is a cedar. I would be fine with a beer, crisp lager, as summer demands. I'd be fine pretending to weed, which is really just an occasion to walk barefoot and look closely at different kinds of flora, few of which I can name. But that's not my object yet, naming. For whatever reason, I'm totally content in just recognizing differences, peculiarities. Sure, I know what mint is. That's easy. But what about the one that surges upward, sort of hunched toward the sun with rows and rows of thick, rounded leaflets, all a healthy yellow-green? It grows in abundance, or there's never one in isolation, so I guess because of its aggressiveness, it would generally be deemed an undesirable plant. But I don't know what it is, so I'll leave it be. Let it bloom and see if I'm interested in its flower. There are two kinds of plants, those I'm interested in and those I'm not. Now, I know this is crude, in the same way that David Hickey is crude. Several years ago, after The Invisible Dragon, a text from David Hickey, I saw Hickey give a talk at the University of Miami at Ohio, where my partner was going to school. Hickey was a real star, making his rounds to all the universities and art institutions, speaking to attentive and eager crowds, and I remember being struck at how nervous he seemed. I believe that he knew there wasn't much to his thoughts about art. He is a what you see is what you get kind of guy. And maybe he was just waiting for someone to dress him down. Maybe every time he spoke, he was waiting for it, and it never happened. And the longer it persisted, the longer he went without challenge, the more nervous he became. I remember him saying, through little snorts and sweaty puffs, something like, you could break down art the same way you could break down rock and roll. You either like the Beatles or you like the Stones. He liked the Stones. Now, having said this, having written it, I went back and reread The Invisible Dragon. I think I'm wrong. These impressions of Hickey were from a younger Steve, a student with fantasies of out-achieving everyone around him, especially traveling lecturers like Hickey. But that's how it goes. It's okay to harness a sense of self-importance, even if it's delusional, as it always is. But it's imperative. How else does one get things started? The hope is that the momentum generated during these brief, early passages of naivety and vanity will support a lifelong practice. So the trick is to firstly be okay with the prick that used to so easily dismiss David Hickey. There's nothing to be ashamed of. One can admit the position, but one needn't be beholden to it. It's not who I am right now. I also used to make pictures whose influences were scrawled across them, like graffiti, a ghostly graffiti, sprayed silently, and when I awoke, my fingers were sure enough stained with the colors of my canvas. My forefinger sore. But there's no sense in pretending I didn't do it. Steve Katrositz, the artist whose work is in the other room, he was my painting professor in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, where he seemed a total anomaly. Before the internet, those days before the ease of the web, he seemed to have total information on the New York gallery scene. He would talk excitedly about upcoming shows, Jessica Stockholder, Elizabeth Murray, Larry Pittman, Ross Blechner. He knew it all. Every year he'd take a bunch of art students from Eau Claire onto a bus bound for Manhattan. The public was welcome to come along too, and they did. Steve would hand out itineraries that were clearly researched, carefully researched, mainly his taste, which was great. We'll talk more about Steve in a bit, but for now I just want to mention how much he means to me, how his enthusiasm and knowledge of contemporary art enriched my life in ways that run extraordinarily deep. It was on his tour of New York that I first experienced a Richard Foreman play. Installation art, enormous tubs of yellow and brown spices, fresh fish markets, brown bagged street beers, hot rotting garbage, and cheap eggs in the morning. In short, it was Steve who introduced me to a city. And it was Steve who said, a month or so ago, while visiting him at his home in Eau Claire, that while pointing at this picture, a picture I sold to him many years ago when I was an undergraduate student, and a picture which was proving to be way too big and cumbersome for his home, he said, pointing, that I could really make an image. And true or not, his saying it meant more to me than whatever achievement I felt after having produced the dozens and dozens of images before and after. Now this is thorny, because an artist shouldn't need the approval of an external authority in order to find meaning in her work. In fact, I'm probably romanticizing Steve a bit, or at least my relationship to his judgment. There was a time when his praise meant what I just indicated, but one has to grow up. And so now I both love him and value what I do, no matter what he thinks of me and my efforts. We're still on trick number one, where the firstly was being okay with ignoring those parts of your past that are no longer useful, while simultaneously acknowledging and honoring, every once in a while so as not to indulge in nostalgia, those parts that renew a sense, albeit false, of self. For instance, I renounce the human who dismissed David Hickey, but I choose to hold on to the character that came out the other end of the Lincoln Tunnel, forever changed. The second trick, or secondly, which I briefly mentioned above, is to get enough momentum during those naive and vain years to ensure that later, proper rest can be achieved without any real noticeable hit to your overall productivity. Being that this is the Green Gallery, I imagine that there would be some younger folks in the audience. So much of that first bit of this talk was for you. I hope it helps. Claude Levi-Strauss might agree with my impulse in the first passage to instruct. In conversations with Claude Levi-Strauss, a book of transcriptions from several conversations or interviews made for French television in October, November, and December of 1959, Levi-Strauss speaks pretty candidly with Georges Charbonnier on such subjects as anthropology and, for our purposes, art. I'll be citing this book, this transcription, a few times tonight. It gives my talk some weight, as Claude Levi-Strauss is no slouch. And I like to talk about thinkers who have something to say about art while not really being artists themselves. This is a bad comparison, but some of the most interesting or lively things that get said in my classroom oftentimes come from the mouths of non-filmmakers or non-artists. That's not a rule, but it does happen, because I think these students haven't been fully initiated. They don't know what they're supposed to say, or what does and doesn't count when talking about film or art. They're a little looser with their ideas. Not always, but often. Anyway, Levi-Strauss might agree with my rough sentiment regarding instruction in art. He says that art is, quote, not only there to provide a consumer with a sensuous satisfaction, art is also a guide, a means of instruction, a way of acquiring knowledge about reality. I think my use of instruction was slightly more moral than what Levi-Strauss had in mind, or at the very least, my hint at instruction, how to grow as an artist or something like that, is more akin to graceful living philosophy, something I think about quite a bit. Recently, I was mousing through openculture.com, listening to all sorts of lectures and sound clips. I recommend the free courses where one can listen to what seems like a semester's worth of talks by renowned intellectuals such as Leo Strauss and John Searle. If you check out John Searle's links, the first one anyway, on the social construction of reality, it won't take long before you want to soak your ears. Not because the content is off-putting, quite the contrary, because the form of the thing is just awful. Sounds like someone is running a wad of steel across the microphone. My worst freshman could make a better recording. The freshman that showed up once in the middle of the semester and asked me to clarify a project that was due 3 weeks prior. I also listened to a short clip of Noam Chomsky that apparently caused a bit of a stir in the open culture community. He takes to task much of French theory, basically denouncing it as pure obfuscation or celebrity seeking through mystification. And in another posting, John Searle basically agreed. He said he talked with some of these guys, contemporaries of his, Foucault and Bourdieu, and they admitted that for the French public, a good chunk of the writing has to be sort of inexplicable in order for it to carry any value. Chomsky went so far as to call Lacan, who he knew and liked, a charlatan. Now, there's a part of me that sympathizes with the general criticism, but there's also a part of me that bristles because at one time I felt a certain kind of charge when reading French theory, a charge similar to the one I get when in the presence of good art, by which I simply mean art that does something for me, edifies me, causes real curiosity in me, causes me to deliberate, to think and rethink. I take that sort of writing to be a kind of poetry. Forget the theory. The stuff can simply be poetic and puzzling. Qualities I admire in works of art. I'm okay with a little mystification. Not everything needs to be answered for. Good works reward individuals who seek. In the face of a good work, the seeking is amplified, regenerated with a continuing promise. If one wants closure, then good art, the art that I value, and I guess some French theory, if one wants closure when engaging with the latter, then one will more than likely be disappointed, perhaps angry. I don't think Chomsky and Searle want closure. They want clarity, and perhaps more honesty about the form, and I don't really disagree with them. I promised you some more material from conversations with Claude Levi-Strauss, so here it is. For Levi-Strauss, art is halfway between the object and language. Now he's talking about the object as in the thing being represented. So in landscape painting, the object is the actual landscape. The painting, the art, is halfway between that, the object of the painting, and language. Poetry, then, for Levi-Strauss, is halfway between art and language. Why do I bring this up? To be honest, I think I like it when a declaration, especially about art, initiates in my mind a diagram. Another bit of language from conversations is that, and I'm not sure this one lends itself to the diagrammatic, quote, the true function of aesthetic transformation or promotion is to raise to the level of the significant something which does not exist in this mode or form in its raw state. That feels right to me. The operative term is transformation, the recognizing and drawing out of the original object through rendering or recombination, that which is latent or, as Levi-Strauss suggests, non-existent. I appreciate when thinkers make statements such as, the true function of aesthetic transformation is. Of course, its strength immediately makes me wary, but just the same, I do feel like it's a good thing for someone to go out on a limb now and then. I feel like I'm supposed to be talking about my art, given that this is an artist talk. What I would say is that in my work you might find the rhetoric of humility, or the rhetoric of plainness or simpleness, or to mine a term I quite like, and last used for my modest arts residency some 5 or so years ago, quotidian, the rhetoric of the quotidian, which is nothing new, I know that. Behind me are a few wonderful studies of studies, studies of one another, studies of something, perfectly sexual little objects that are essential to my living space. They were painted by my partner's aunt, Gretchen Reynolds. To my left, a piece of firewood transported from Maquonago, a piece of wood pretty badly muffed by my partner, Jess, with an axe. Over here, I mentioned this object already, an old drawing, renewed with a few words by Steve Petrosits, now a bookshelf. The far object, the one on the pedestal, the far object, a garden accident. And on the opposite wall, my favorite, is a collection from a shared drain in a past home. Many of you know Janine. Some of her leavings are inevitably featured in those frames.
What's yours?
Shared. Now, like I said, nothing radically new here, but I'm not convinced that I need to constantly invent. I'm currently working on a video that was shot in central Minnesota at a wood tick race. The tick race is a MacGuffin. I think the real foundation of the work will be the decline of mining in this area and the resulting depopulation and economic demise. Or it might be about the creation of an annual convivial space, a real human accomplishment. Or both. I won't know until I edit. Which is how it goes with most of my practice. I don't recommend this process, only if it works for you. Whatever works. I learned this as a painter at Eau Claire, again, under the instruction of Steve Petrosits. You have before you an empty canvas, and you simply have to make something happen. This was a great lesson. Steve mobilized the art practice of many, many young students, many more than one would ever expect from a place like Eau Claire, Wisconsin. To name just a few humans touched by Steve, a very few that come to mind immediately, include, say, Sarah Black, co-founder of Material Exchange in Chicago and a recent hire at the School of the Art Institute in Chicago, Craig Olson, who went on to study at Rutgers and continues to paint and exhibit around New York City and writes art reviews for the Brooklyn Rail. Janine Ross, who earned an MFA at the University of Miami at Ohio in painting and was a member of the local and much-loved performance group, Tingle Showcase. Dustin Larson, who was accepted into the extremely prestigious Rijksacademy in Amsterdam. Artist and filmmaker Andrew Swant, who's drawn out psychedelic period piece Hamlet ADD is going to have a premiere at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Los Angeles, and who co-wrote and starred in The Dahmer Files, which was picked up by IFC. Me, before you, currently an assistant professor at UW-Milwaukee in film. Dan Peterman, a highly respected and sought-after artist who teaches at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and who founded the Experimental Station in Hyde Park. Now that's just off the top of my head. All of these folks were turned on by Steve, I guarantee it. They'll tell you, if you ask each, who was a model for you? Who got you excited about contemporary art? Who made you feel like you wanted to and could achieve great things? And each will tell you, Steve Katrosis. I've never had wet dreams about any of my mentors. I guess I've only had two wet dreams total, but still, none were about or involved any of my mentors. Which is unexpected, really, given the erotics of excited learning and authority. Wet dreams seem perfect for the student-mentor scenario. A wet dream is built on the absence of physicality, just some images, maybe the slight pressure of underwear, pajamas, but it's basically hands-off, where one sort of gives oneself into it, into total ecstasy, allowing oneself the power of the dream, which is to be alert enough to experience self-augmentation, while still being vulnerable enough to fail, to make a mess of things. Failure in the presence of a real mentor is absolutely essential. I know Steve would love to be here to see you all, and undoubtedly he'd charm you with his strange, toothy smile and his listening. He's a great listener. I realized this Saturday while alone in the truck with his paintings, somewhere outside Mauston. I was trying to imitate him, but couldn't. It hit me how what I really see and feel when I try to conjure him is his listening. He's not passive. He's just a generous, attentive listener. A good trait for a teacher, not so good for imitations. Right now, I'd like to read a short passage Steve wrote for the show, language he put to paper for his exhibition in this room behind me. Like I said, I can't do his voice or delivery any justice. It really would be a failure that I'm not interested in acting right now. So I'm just gonna read it straight. But I feel like I have a responsibility to try and channel him a little bit. So, again, I can't speak like him. I tried for 3 hours. I couldn't do it. And to be serious, I actually am pretty good with voices. So it's not like, I didn't try. So I put my effort in the props. This will just take a second. People who know him will be like, that's ridiculous. What do you think, Andrew? Janine?
Not close. Pretty good.
I guess I do know his. My works are based primarily on architecture of the 1920s and 1930s, especially functionalism. My travel was focused on places where such architecture is found, returning to explore more. Amsterdam, Utrecht, Rotterdam, Arnhem, Berlin, Vienna, Prague, Brno, and Budapest. I miss Moscow. My paralysis has halted such activity. My wife and I have located to a ground floor studio in Banbury Place with convenient access for my wheelchair so I can paint again after a brief hiatus. As mentioned, my paintings are based on architecture, recent ones with a digital image contrasting with acrylic in a found frame. The frame establishes the size and proportions of the painting. The digital image is the spark, completed in acrylics. The quality I admire is in the often stark black and white photographs, at times retouched, of the functionalist villas. The last paintings were based on Russian revolutionary posters and an apartment lobby by the Hungarian architect Farkas Molnár.
I think Steve would have been impressed by that.
I said it's okay.
I want to say one more thing in closing. Steve Katrosis certainly does not need my sympathy. But when leaving his home, a nursing home where, by the way, I forced down my throat the worst bratwurst on the planet. It really hit me how unfair the whole thing is. His doctor's botched and late diagnosis of prostate cancer, the wild growth of the cancer, his ensuing paralysis from the waist down, his living in a place where it seems he has no intellectual partners as his mind remains super sharp. And on top of it all, he has to eat sausages of the worst sort. Yeah. Steve loved sausages. It killed me to see him eat that garbage. We did, however, gain the satisfaction of fixing his Kindle, or we figured out how to browse the web on that device, which for whatever reason was not at all intuitive. And we did get to drink good beer in his studio, Dogfish Head 90-minute pale ale, and Palo Santo Marron, a brown ale of 12% alcohol, brewed in handmade Paraguayan Palo Santo wooden tanks. It was a task to get through it. He also loves beer. And we did get to sift through his paintings that I proudly escorted across the state to share with you. And beard brushing against beard, we did muddle through a kiss.
Well, that's it. Thanks for coming out.
Not at all.